Hello, I'm Nick Champeau. Coming up in the program.
He believes in a strong France, and that's an element of continuity. But there is some optimism among the reformers. He may not be the Francis Thatcher that some people are presenting him as, but still a little bit more liberal economically. But we know that Sarkozy can be a little bit unpredictable. He, in the past, has not been beyond criticizing other leaders, including Mr. Zapatero from Spain.
He's energetic, pragmatic, but he's also unpredictable. The French have chosen Nicolas Sarkozy as president. We'll look at the possible repercussions of his election for Europe. The president-elect got back from his jet-set holiday in Malta just in time for the event commemorating France's abolition of slavery. We'll have a report on the ceremony in Paris, and we'll also go to Northern Ireland.
With hard work and commitment to succeed, I believe we can lay the foundation for a better, peaceful and prosperous future for all the people of Northern Ireland.
Northern Ireland entered a new era this week as Protestant and Catholic arch-enemies were sworn in to share power. We'll have a portrait of the province's new prime minister, hardline Protestant Ian Paisley. And later in the program, we'll have an interview with the founder of the alternative Nobel Prize, Jacob van Uexküll, on his new project, the World Future Council. I know it sounds like science fiction, but in fact, it's all about saving the planet. Actually, you can help him. Later in the program, we'll have a report from Stockholm on what you can do to fight climate change. All that in Network Europe, a partnership of the continent's leading broadcasters. But first to our main story. As you probably know by now, Nicolas Sarkozy won the presidential election in France. The 52-year-old leader of the right-wing UMP party garnered 53% of the votes in the second-round ballot. How did people in Brussels react to the news? I discussed the issue with our EU insider, Stephen Castle. He first told me that for many, Sarkozy's election came as a relief because unlike his competitor, the defeated socialist Ségolène Royal, Sarkozy does not intend to hold another referendum on the union's future institutions.
Indeed, exactly that's the case. It was a relief. I think that's probably the result that most people in the corridors of power here in Brussels wanted because, as you say, Monsieur Sarkozy has pledged not to have a referendum on any successor to the European Constitution. However, one key problem remains, and that is what is in this document that the EU heads of government want to agree this year. Mr. Sarkozy calls it a mini treaty, a slimmed down treaty. Now, if he can agree the broad lines of this with the other big countries, notably Germany and Great Britain, there's a lot of confidence that actually there could be a deal quite quickly.
But how different will Sarkozy be from Jacques Chirac on the, I don't know, on the common agricultural policy, for instance, which eats a lot of EU money, or on relations with the United States?
Well, this is one of the big questions. And the answer is we simply, as yet, don't know. There are similarities and there are big differences between Sarkozy and Mr. Chirac. He is in the great tradition of Gaullists, Sarkozy. He believes in a strong France, and that's an element of continuity. And I would certainly not expect him to want to abandon many of the traditional policies of France. He may be a little bit softer on the common agricultural policy, but he's unlikely to want to scrap it. He will almost certainly want to protect French industry, the great champion, the national champions of France, industrial champions. And let's not forget that it was he who was finance minister who helped organize a state bailout of Alstom. But there is some optimism among the reformers, countries like, for example, the UK, that Sarkozy will be a little bit more flexible. He will be more interested in economic reform. He may not be the Francis Thatcher that some people are presenting him as, but still a little bit more liberal economically.
You mentioned the UK, Stephen. We all remember the Jacques Chirac, Tony Blair rows during council summits in Brussels. They were almost a classic. Now, what about Nicolas Sarkozy and Gordon Brown? Will they be the EU's new dream team, or the opposite of that?
Well, it's going to be fascinating to see. We don't really know a lot about the personal chemistry between these two people. We know that Sarkozy can be a little bit unpredictable. He, in the past, has not been beyond criticizing other leaders, including Mr. Zapatero from Spain. I suspect there's going to be some areas of acute difference between France and Britain. And I suspect these are underlying forces that are always there in Anglo-French relations. And it's going to be fascinating to see whether Mr. Brown can restrain his natural instinct to lecture and Mr. Sarkozy can restrain his natural temper. I think we can say one or two other things about him. Clearly, he's a power politician. He likes dealing with the powerful countries. When he was interior minister, he very much championed the idea of the big five EU countries getting together and cooperating. And I think that's one trend we'll see. And that means that his relationship with Mr. Brown, and in particular with Angela Merkel of Germany, will be absolutely crucial. And the quality of that relationship will probably determine the strength of the leadership for Europe in the years to follow.
That was Network Europe's EU insider Stephen Castle on the line from Brussels. Nicolas Sarkozy said that Europe was one of his top priorities as proof. His first foreign trips will be to Brussels, the seat of the European Commission, and Germany, which currently chairs the rotating presidency of the EU. But Sarkozy is not president yet. Jacques Chirac is due to step down next Wednesday. Nicolas Sarkozy took 2 days off to rest and prepare for the role of president. His expensive retreat has sparked off a controversy. The president-elect flew on a private jet and went cruising on a luxury yacht, all courtesy of Vincent Bolloré, a friendly billionaire businessman. Anyway, Sarkozy returned just in time to attend the commemoration of France's abolition of slavery. Last year, President Chirac chose May the 10th as Remembrance Day for the victims of slavery. This was hailed by friends and foes alike as a breakthrough in France's efforts to come to terms with its colonial past. Interestingly, last year, Nicolas Sarkozy supported a controversial law which acknowledged the positive role of colonialism and has said on numerous occasions during his campaign that he hated remorse. More on the issue with Radio France International's Jan van der Made in Paris.
No speeches at the ceremony in the Jardin de Luxembourg, but songs and poems like this song, The Liberty of the Blacks, performed by Serge Hureau.
Saviez-vous, républicain, quel sort était le sort?
And the inauguration of a monument, three links of a broken chain, symbolizing freedom. The day to remember the evils of slave trade and its abolition was created last year by President Jacques Chirac, who in 2001 passed a law officially recognizing the slave trade as a crime against humanity. I asked Jean-Louis Tain, spokesperson for Le Cran, an organization which represents blacks living in France, what this day means to him.
First of all, it is a great victory, because formerly there was no date for such an event, abolition of slavery. So French black organization, and not only human rights organization in general, ask for these days. And second, it is also a way to promote cultural diversity and historical knowledge. So thanks to that, it is easier now to speak about this issue in the society and especially in classrooms. So this is also a great and important thing for us.
Dr. Françoise Verger, member of the Committee to Commemorate Slavery and a sociology teacher in England, attended the ceremony as well.
You know, since the abolition of slavery in 1848, France never spoke again. about slave trade and slavery, and we discovered that history barely 6 years ago. So it's really the starting point, I will say, of a large movement, I hope, of recovering that history and looking at what that meant for today.
In how far does the collective memory for colored people of slave trade still echo in present-day life?
Well, in the former slavery society, Réunion, Martinique, Guadeloupe and Guyane, that memory is still very present. It's present even though it was really repressed, but it's present in the language, in the food, in the music, and also in the fact that people ask themselves, who are we? We are black people, descendants of Africans, thrown on this island, and we are being told we are French, but nonetheless, when we were free, they gave us citizenship, but we were still colonized. The end of colonial status was just in 1946, and we are still a citizen, but not quite equal. So it's a question of who are we, and do we belong to that national narrative of France, which does not give us any line to our history?
Well, Nicolas Sarkozy, the president-elect, was there too. But past remarks he made sparked controversy. He said, among other things, that France should not have remorse about its past. On the contrary, it should be proud of its history. I asked Jean-Louis Tin what he thought of the presence of Nicolas Sarkozy at the meeting.
Well, Mr. Sarkozy is more than ambiguous. He's coming back from his holiday to commemorate the event, which is a positive thing. But on the other side, he made many remarks, for instance, saying that we should not have any remorse about the history of colonization. It was a good thing, which are unbearable speech. So it is really hard to say what's going to happen now. Is he going to go on with this provocative attitude, or is he going to change? Because he always says that he's changing, but I hope he's not changing every day. And I think it is not going to be possible for him to go on, because if he wants to have some positive relationship with other countries in the world, namely countries in Africa, it's not possible to insult statesmen like this all over the world. So he has to change in a way. And I think he's already able to understand that. So this is why he's coming to this commemoration first, before going to Africa. He understands that there is a relationship between the commemoration of the past and the handling of international relations.
For now, descendants of former slaves and people from the French colonies are taking a wait-and-see attitude. It now remains to be seen in how far and if Sarkozy will manage to appease France's offspring of its colonies, and if not, they will be the first to remind him once again of France's colonial past.
And thanks to RFI's Jan van der Made for that report. You're listening to Network Europe. Still to come, a new council was founded in Hamburg this week, the World Future Council.
The renewable energy promotion is no doubt the most important thing now, because what we cannot afford anymore is to waste the sun and the wind of today, because the sun and wind of today we can never use tomorrow. They'll be lost forever.
Jakob von Uexküll, the founder of the World Future Council, will tell us how he intends to bring together all the organizations and all the people concerned about the state of our planet. But first, we head to Northern Ireland. After decades of violence and division, this week saw the inauguration of an historic power-sharing government in the long-troubled province. Rival Protestants and Catholics will take their seats in the freshly revived Northern Ireland Assembly. The Conservative Protestant DUP party won elections there last month, with the Catholic Sinn Féin coming second. The hardline Protestant leader, 81-year-old Reverend Ian Paisley, will become the province's first minister. Radio Netherlands correspondent in the UK, Leah van Beekhoven, has this portrait of the man who finally changed his mind.
Hey, never! Never!
It's what typified Ian Paisley for 40 years, saying no, never, no surrender, and not giving an inch to his enemies. Paisley mixed politics and religion with uncompromising zeal. He blocked power sharing with Catholics, or in Paisley speak, Papists, called the Pope the Antichrist, and urged the IRA to be destroyed. And when that did not work, humiliated.
The IRA needs to be humiliated. And they need to wear their sackcloth and ashes, not in a back room, but openly. And we have no apology for the stand we're taking.
when finally there was an IRA ceasefire and a peace agreement, it was not sufficient for Dr. Paisley. Nor did he want a debate about Northern Ireland's position within the UK. Involvement of the Irish Republic and its Prime Minister Bertie O'Hearn was off the agenda.
Bertie O'Hearn must be told to keep his dirty hands of interference off the internal affairs of Northern Ireland. We are part of this United Kingdom, and here we are going to remain.
3 years ago, Paisley went on his first official visit to that same Prime Minister O'Hearn. Dr. No started to say, maybe.
I'd like to think that we would have a quiet province. I'd like to think that people said the man of war was a man of peace.
Paisley's wish was to see the IRA surrendered. The Republicans didn't only have to down all arms, they had to hand them over too. And they had to recognise the police. It was what most Protestants wanted. And Ian Paisley, who, according to one biographer, always stayed close to the wishes of his supporters, was not going to deviate from that norm now.
He will not lose touch with his core base, those folk up in Ballymena, those people who are in the heartlines of the DUP. If they're not prepared to shift, in the end, he won't shift.
In March, Paisley's party again won the elections. He saw it as a mandate to finally accept devolved power with Sinn Féin, the political party of the IRA. It must have been the hardest decision of his political career.
With hard work and commitment to succeed, I believe we can lay the foundation for a better, peaceful and prosperous future for all the people of Northern Ireland.
Concerns about his legacy played a role too, says one commentator. Paisley is 81. Surely this is his last chance to lead a Northern Irish government.
No doubt that Paisley does think about his legacy, and certainly a man who is always very close to the scriptures, he will be quite concerned that he will go down as Moses rather than Joshua, because Moses never saw the promised land.
More remarkable than Paisley's words has been his body language. Last week, newspapers carried a picture of Ian Paisley with one of Sinn Féin's leaders. It was not the first time the two were photographed. What was new was that they were both laughing.
That was Radio Netherlands' Lia van Beethoven. Well, now let's see whether the entire world can unite to fight climate change. Coastlines are under threat, deserts are advancing, and the effects of climate change are set to displace millions of people as resources become more scarce. Well, the World Future Council wants to stop that and gathered for its founding congress in Hamburg this week. This new council is the brainchild of Jacob van Uexküll, who also founded the Right Livelihood Award, also known as the Alternative Nobel Prize. The goal of his international council is an ambitious one. In a nutshell, its aim is to save the planet. Deutsche Welle's Barbara Gruber asked him how this can be done.
By working very closely with decision makers, especially with parliamentarians, to highlight solutions which already exist, to identify and research those which may not be known yet, and then make sure they're implemented. We have already begun to do this by having a hearing with parliamentarians, with heads of energy committees in Nairobi after the big UN climate conference there some months ago, as a result of which the energy legislation in three African countries is already being improved. So these are, you know, very concrete steps based on the fact that, you know, we know what needs to be done in many areas, but the political will seems to be lacking. And so I felt by creating an organization which specifically speaks up as a strong voice of future generations, we could create this extra will. You know, the Americans said during their War of Independence, they had a slogan which was no taxation without representation. And today, of course, we are taxing the very lives of future generations, but we're not giving them a say in the matter. There were organizations in the past, even called councils of seers into the future in pre-colonial India. But today, when our influence on the future is longer term and bigger than ever, we lack such an institution until now.
But how is the World Future Council different from other international organizations dealing with important global issues?
Well, this specific spokes organization for future generations, of course, that focus has not existed before. We are not interested in what's supposedly politically realistic today. We're interested in what is necessary, and then we're working to make that politically realistic. We are long-term. Existing institutions, commissions are often quite short-term. They have a short mandate. They produce a very good declaration, and then they expect somebody else, usually the UN, to implement it, and that really hasn't worked. We're also looking at various issues together. You know, all our great crises in the globe today are integrated, are hang together, but most institutions which exist at the moment are highly specialized. And I think that's another reason why we are still not moving ahead as fast as we must.
You mentioned earlier you'll be working closely with parliamentarians, so you will involve democratically elected parliamentarians as well as over 6,000 NGOs, the media and the public. In practice, how will this work?
Well, with the parliamentarians, it's very concrete because there is a new electronic network developing, linking all the world's democratically elected national members of parliament called the e-Parliament Initiative. And in fact, this hearing we held in Nairobi and the future hearings we'll be holding will be jointly with e-Parliament. So that link already exists. As far as civil society goes, we did write to these 6,000 organizations to get nominations. You know, who is the person in your part of the world you think would be a credible member of this World Future Council? And of course, the media are crucial for getting the message out, because if we look at climate chaos, for example, you know, this has been a huge market failure. It's also been a political failure, and it's also been a media failure, because people have thought that it's a problem for future generations. Maybe, you know, it's coming up in hundreds of years, and now suddenly it's hitting us now. You know, in Australia, they're talking about evacuating whole cities because of lack of water. So I think there is an awareness there. There's an openness to work with us in many of these organizations. I don't think that'll be a problem. People are waiting for integrated answers to the crisis we're facing.
Now, fighting climate change is one of your utmost priorities. What are going to be the first measures or steps the World Future Council will take?
The renewable energy promotion is no doubt the most important thing now, because what we cannot afford anymore is to waste the sun and the wind of today, because the sun and wind of today we can never use tomorrow. They'll be lost forever. And that's why it's nonsense to say, oh, you know, they are still too expensive. That's really basically immaterial. If we have the resources and the workers to install these installations, if we have the materials to build them, then we must do it, because ecologically we're losing out. We can never solve the problem. So we are focusing, therefore, on promoting legislation, the best legislation, to spread renewable energies. And that, interestingly enough, is a German law, which is called the renewable energy sort of feed-in legislation here, which has spread to over 40 countries and regions worldwide, and which also is very sort of democratic, because you encourage people to do something themselves. You don't sit and wait for some huge companies which have been part of the problem to suddenly decide they want to be part of the solution.
But would you say that climate change threatens to overshadow other pressing global problems, such as fighting AIDS and reducing poverty?
Well, the problem is not that it overshadows it. The problem is that it makes them more serious. You cannot solve poverty if you're going to have an ongoing climate chaos. I mean, a stable climate, you know, natural laws override all economic laws, override all cultures, everything, because they determine the preconditions for our existence. So it is quite clear that all our gains in fighting poverty and fighting hunger are going to disappear very quickly if we can't reduce climate chaos, and we're going to get lots of new illnesses spreading to places in the world where they have been defeated or never been before.
Jacob von Uexküll, founder of the Alternative Nobel Prize and initiator of the World Future Council, speaking to Deutsche Welle's Barbara Gruber. Now you, yes, you listeners, can help save the planet. The United Nations International Panel on Climate Change concluded at its recent meeting that global warming can be tackled effectively and even at a reasonable cost. The scientific group also urges ordinary people to review their lifestyles as part of the global fight to reduce carbon dioxide emissions. So, what is the interest on the streets like? Radio Sweden's Azaria Kiros reports from Stockholm.
Swedes pride themselves on environmental issues. After all, the world's first global mega-conference on the environment was held in Stockholm in 1972 as a recognition to Sweden's contribution to effort to create environmental awareness. Anyway, how serious is the problem we're facing?
It's a real, real serious problem.
It's serious, I think. Yeah, it's very serious.
It's quite obvious that we have a problem there.
Global warming may or may not be a problem, but
Whether it's caused by man, I'm not convinced.
As the world wakes up to the sudden realization that we may be on the verge of climatic changes of apocalyptic magnitude and must therefore galvanize our resources, Swedes are the first to jump on the bandwagon. Emmaline Barry is climate expert at the Swedish Society for Nature Conservation.
It has been a big increase, of course, in people's interest since this autumn with the Al Gore movie that came out. We had the UN reports talking about the emergency or urgency to do something. And, of course, there are quite a number of instances where we do see that climate is changing. We just heard about the new island that was created outside Greenland because the glacier is melting so quickly. So I think there is a big increase in people's interest.
Fine. It's good to be aware of the enormity of the problem, but how prepared are people to be actively involved in the fight to reduce the emission of harmful gases into the atmosphere? And how much worried are people by the development?
It's a real, real serious problem.
It's actually very serious, but it's hard to know as a single person what to do about it. It's hard to do anything about it yourself, kind of that feeling.
It's very serious, I think.
Yeah. How much worried are you about it?
Not so very much right now, but in the future perhaps it could be not so good.
It's serious, I think. Yeah, it's very serious.
Quite obvious that we have a problem there.
And what needs to be done about it?
To drive an environmentally car, as I do, in fact.
I'm only 15, so I'm not so involved with that.
But it concerns your future.
Yeah, it does.
Your generation.
Yeah, it does, really. But I don't know so much about it.
It's on my mind a lot. I think about it every day, and that should concern us. It should concern us because it's not normal.
Well, I think it's a sad story if we continue on the way we're going now.
And how do we avoid those problems which will affect more the next generations? What can I, you, he and she do at the individual level to help reduce the effect of global warming? Emmaline Barry of the Swedish Nature Conservation Society says energy is one important sector.
One important aspect is, of course, what kind of electricity you use. You can choose to use one that is not particularly dependent on fossil fuels. I can lower the temperature in my house, especially when I'm not there. I can use the tumble dryer less, and there, for example, you can save 280 kilos of carbon dioxide per year. When you do have to drive your car, you could ensure that the pressure in the wheels is the right, and by making sure it's the right one, one can save 140 tons of carbon dioxide.
So what are those who are committed to the cause doing to contribute their bit to the fight against climate change?
I can go bicycle instead of using the car, and that's what I'm doing.
Do we need, as individuals, to sort of review our lifestyle?
I think so, yes. Absolutely.
I'm not convinced. I'm not quite sure.
So we don't need to do anything? We continue living the way we do? We don't need to revise our lifestyles or whatever?
I'm uncertain about that, yeah.
That was Radio Sweden's Azaria Kiros. And I'm afraid that's almost all we have time for on this week's Network Europe. Just a quick reminder of our quiz question for this month. We would like you to name two female European heads of state. If you think you know the answer, the address, contact@networkeurope.org. That's contact@networkeurope.org. Name two female European heads of state. And please visit our website if you want to listen to this program again or subscribe to our podcasts, www.networkeurope.org. For me, Nick Champeau in Paris, it's goodbye and thanks for joining us. And thanks to studio producer Joanna Labetz and sound engineer Bertrand Eclair. We'll leave you with music. It's from Damon Albarn's new project, The Good, the Bad and the Queen. And I thought this song was appropriate because we talked a lot about saving the earth this week. And this song is called Nature Springs. Have a wonderful weekend. Bye-bye.